Chapter 99. I raised my mother up, praying and beseeching her, not to stoop before me in such affliction and humiliation. I did so in broken, incoherent words, for besides the trouble I was in, it frightened me to see her at my feet. I told her, or I tried to tell her that, if it were for me, her child, under any circumstances to take upon me to forgive her, I did it, and had done it, many, many years. I told her, that my heart overflowed with love for her, that it was natural love which nothing in the past had changed or could change. That it was not for me, then resting for the first time on my mother's bosom, to take her to account for having given me life, but that my duty was to bless her and receive her, though the whole world turned from her, and that I only asked her leave to do it. I held my mother in my embrace, and she held me in hers, and among the still woods in the silence of the summer day there seemed to be nothing but our two troubled minds that was not at peace. To bless and receive me, groaned my mother, it is far too late. I must travel my dark road alone, and it will lead me where it will. From day to day, sometimes from hour to hour, I do not see the way before my guilty feet. This is the earthly punishment I have brought upon myself. I bear it, and I hide it. Even in the thinking of her endurance, she drew her habitual air of proud indifference about her like a veil, though she soon cast it off again. I must keep this secret, if by any means it can be kept, not wholly for myself. I have a husband, wretched and dishonoring creature that I am. These words she uttered with a suppressed cry of despair, more terrible in its sound than any shriek. Covering her face with her hands, she shrank down in my embrace, as if she were unwilling that I should touch her, nor could I, by my utmost persuasions, or by any endearments I could use, prevail upon her to rise. She said, "No, no, no, she could only speak to me so. She must be proud and disdainful everywhere else. She would be humbled and ashamed there, in the only natural moments of her life." My unhappy mother told me that in my illness she had been nearly frantic. She had but then known that her child was living. She could not have suspected me to be that child before. She had followed me down here to speak to me, but once in all her life. We never could associate, never could communicate, never probably from that time forth could interchange another word on earth. She put into my hands a letter she had written for my reading only, and said when I had read it, and destroyed it, but not so much for her sake, since she asked nothing, as for her husband's and my own I must evermore consider her as dead. If I could believe that she loved me, in this agony in which I saw her, with a mother's love, she asked me to do that, for then I might think of her with a greater pity, imagining what she suffered. She had put herself beyond all hope, and beyond all help. Whether she preserved her secret until death, or it came to be discovered, and she brought dishonor and disgrace upon the name she had taken, it was her solitary struggle always, and no affection could come near her, and no human creature could render her any aid. But is the secret safe so far? I asked. Is it safe now, dearest mother? No, replied my mother. It has been very near discovery. It was saved by an accident. It may be lost by another accident tomorrow, any day. Do you dread a particular person? Hush! Do not tremble, and cry so much for me. I am not worthy of these tears, said my mother, kissing my hands. I dread one person very much. An enemy? Not a friend. One who is too passionless to be either. He is Sir Leicester Dedlock's lawyer, mechanically faithful without attachment, and very jealous of the profit, privilege, and reputation of being master of the mysteries of great houses. Has he any suspicions? Many. Not of you? I said alarmed. Yes. He is always vigilant, and always near me. I may keep him at a standstill, but I can never shake him off. Has he so little pity or compunction? He has none, and no anger. He is indifferent to everything but his calling. His calling is the acquisition of secrets, and the holding possession of such power as they give him, with no sharer or opponent in it. Could you trust in him? I shall never try. The dark road I have trodden for so many years will end where it will. I follow it alone to the end, whatever the end be. It may be near, it may be distant. While the road lasts, nothing turns me. Dear mother, are you so resolved?
I am resolved.
I have long outbidden folly with folly, pride with pride, scorn with scorn, insolence with insolence, and have outlived many vanities with many more. I will outlive this danger, and outdie it, if I can. It has closed around me almost as awfully as if these woods of Chesney Wold had closed around the house, but my course through it is the same. I have but one. I can have but one. Mr. Jarndyce, I was beginning when my mother hurriedly inquired, does he suspect?
No, said one.
No, indeed. Be assured that he does not. And I told her what he had related to me as his knowledge of my story. But he is so good and sensible, said I, that perhaps if he knew my mother, who until this time had made no change in her position, raised her hand up to my lips and stopped me. Confide fully in him, she said after a little while. You have my free consent, a small gift from such a mother to her injured child, but do not tell me of it. Some pride is left in me even yet. I explained, as nearly as I could then, or can recall now, for my agitation and distress throughout were so great, that I scarcely understood myself, though every word that was uttered in the mother's voice, so unfamiliar and so melancholy to me, which in my childhood I had never learned to love and recognize, had never been sung to sleep with, had never heard a blessing from, had never had a hope inspired by, made an enduring impression on my memory. I say I explained, or tried to do it, how I had only hoped that Mr. Jarndyce, who had been the best of fathers to me, might be able to afford some counsel and support to her. But my mother answered no, it was impossible, no one could help her. Through the desert that lay before her, she must go alone. My child, she said. For the last time. These kisses for the last time. These arms upon my neck for the last time. We shall meet no more. To hope to do what I seek to do, I must be what I have been so long. Such is my reward and doom. If you hear of Lady Dedlock, brilliant, prosperous, and flattered, think of your wretched mother, conscience-stricken, underneath that mask. Think that the reality is in her suffering, in her useless remorse, in her murdering within her breast the only love and truth of which it is capable. And then forgive her if you can, and cry to heaven to forgive her, which it never can. We held one another for a little space yet, but she was so firm that she took my hands away and put them back against my breast, and with a last kiss as she held them there, released them, and went from me into the wood. I was alone, and calm and quiet below me in the sun and shade lay the old house, with its terraces and turrets, on which there had seemed to me to be such complete repose when I first saw it, but which now looked like the obdurate and unpitying watcher of my mother's misery. Stunned as I was, as weak and helpless at first as I had ever been in my sick chamber, the necessity of guarding against the danger of discovery, or even of the remotest suspicion, did me service. I took such precautions as I could to hide from Charlie that I had been crying, and I constrained myself to think of every sacred obligation that there was upon me to be careful and collected. It was not a little while before I could succeed, or could even restrain bursts of grief, but after an hour or so I was better, and felt that I might return. I went home very slowly and told Charlie, whom I found at the gate looking for me, that I had been tempted to extend my walk after Lady Dedlock had left me, and that I was overtired, and would lie down. Safe in my own room, I read the letter. I clearly derived from it, and that was much then, that I had not been abandoned by my mother. Her elder and only sister, the godmother of my childhood, discovering signs of life in me, when I had been laid aside as dead, had in her stern sense of duty, with no desire or willingness that I should live, reared me in rigid secrecy, and had never again beheld my mother's face from within a few hours of my birth. So strangely did I hold my place in this world, that until within a short time back I had never, to my own mother's knowledge, breathed, had been buried, had never been endowed with life, had never borne a name. When she had first seen me in the church, she had been startled, and had thought of what would have been like me, if it had ever lived, and had lived on, but that was all then. What more the letter told me needs not to be repeated here. It has its own times and places in my story. My first care was to burn what my mother had written, and to consume even its ashes. I hope it may not appear very unnatural or bad in me, that I then became heavily sorrowful, to think I had ever been reared. That I felt as if I knew it would have been better and happier for many people, if indeed I had never breathed. That I had a terror of myself as the danger, and the possible disgrace of my own mother, and of a proud family name. That I was so confused and shaken, as to be possessed by a belief, that it was right, and had been intended, that I should die in my birth, and that it was wrong, and not intended, that I should be then alive. These are the real feelings that I had. I fell asleep worn out, and when I awoke I cried afresh to think that I was back in the world with my load of trouble for others. I was more than ever frightened of myself, thinking anew of her against whom I was a witness, of the owner of Chesney Wold, of the new and terrible meaning of the old words now moaning in my ear like a surge upon the shore. Your mother, Esther, was your disgrace, and you are hers. The time will come, and soon enough, when you will understand this better, and will feel it too, as no one save a woman can. With them, those other words returned, pray daily that the sins of others be not visited upon your head. I could not disentangle all that was about me, and I felt as if the blame, and the shame were all in me, and the visitation had come down. The day waned into a gloomy evening, overcast and sad, and I still contended with the same distress. I went out alone, and after walking a little in the park, watching the dark shades falling on the trees, and the fitful flight of the bats, which sometimes almost touched me, was attracted to the house for the first time. Perhaps I might not have gone near it, if I had been in a stronger frame of mind. As it was, I took the path that led close by it. I did not dare to linger, or to look up, but I passed before the terrace garden with its fragrant odors, and its broad walks, and its well-kept beds and smooth turf, and I saw how beautiful and grave it was, and how the old stone balustrades and parapets, and white flights of shallow steps, were seamed by time and weather, and how the trained moss and ivy grew about them, and around the old stone pedestal of the sundial, and I heard the fountain falling. Then the way went by long lines of dark windows diversified by turreted towers and porches of eccentric shapes, where old stone lions and grotesque monsters bristled outside dens of shadow, and snarled at the evening gloom over the escutcheons they held in their grip. Thence the path wound underneath a gateway, and through a courtyard, where the principal entrance was. I hurried quickly on, and by the stables where none, but deep voices seemed to be, whether in the murmuring of the wind through the strong mass of ivy holding to a high red wall, or in the low complaining of the weathercock, or in the barking of the dogs, or in the slow striking of a clock. So, encountering presently a sweet smell of limes, whose rustling I could hear, I turned with the turning of the path to the south front, and there above me were the balustrades of the ghost's walk and one lighted window, that might be my mother's. The way was paved here, like the terrace overhead, and my footsteps from being noiseless made an echoing sound upon the flags. Stopping to look at nothing, but seeing all I did see as I went, I was passing quickly on, and in a few moments should have passed the lighted window, when my echoing footsteps brought it suddenly into my mind, that there was a dreadful truth in the legend of the ghost's walk, that it was I who was to bring calamity upon the stately house, and that my warning feet were haunting it even then. Seized with an augmented terror of myself which turned me cold, I ran from myself and everything, retraced the way by which I had come, and never paused until I had gained the lodge gate, and the park lay sullen and black behind me.
not before I was alone in my own room for the night, and had again been dejected and unhappy there did I begin to know how wrong and thankless this state was. But from my darling who was coming on the morrow, I found a joyful letter, full of such loving anticipation, that I must have been of marble, if it had not moved me. From my guardian too, I found another letter, asking me to tell Dom Durden, if I should see that little woman anywhere, that they had moped most pitiably without her, that the housekeeping was going to rack and ruin, that nobody else could manage the keys, and that everybody in and about the house declared it was not the same house, and was becoming rebellious for a return. Two such letters together made me think how far beyond my deserts I was beloved, and how happy I ought to be. That made me think of all my past life, and that brought me, as it ought to have done before, into a better condition. For I saw very well that I could not have been intended to die, or I should never have lived, not to say, should never have been reserved for such a happy life. I saw very well how many things had worked together for my welfare, and that if the sins of the fathers were sometimes visited upon the children, the phrase did not mean what I had in the morning feared it meant. I knew I was as innocent of my birth as a queen of hers, and that before my heavenly father I should not be punished for birth, nor a queen rewarded for it. I had had experience, in the shock of that very day, that I could, even thus soon, find comfort in reconcilements to the change that had fallen on me. I renewed my resolutions and prayed to be strengthened in them, pouring out my heart for myself, and for my unhappy mother, and feeling that the darkness of the morning was passing away. It was not upon my sleep, and when the next day's light awoke me, it was gone. My dear girl was to arrive at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. How to help myself through the intermediate time better than by taking a long walk along the road by which she was to come, I did not know. So Charlie and I and Stub saddled, for we never drove him after the one great occasion, made a long expedition along that road and back. On our return, we held a great review of the house and garden and saw that everything was in its prettiest condition, and had the bird out ready as an important part of the establishment. There were more than 2 full hours yet to elapse before she could come, and in that interval, which seemed a long one, I must confess. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.